Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, where we talk about, I don't know, the things after we talk about weird things. This is actually a show for creatives and other people looking to sort of strike it out on their own or do something different. And it comes from our experience and questionable experiences. And we apologize for all the bad advice we may be giving. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man, welcome back to the land of the living. You were kind of gone for a bit, which if anybody has any questions about what it takes to pull Andrew Main away from the Weird Things and After Things podcast, just trust that it would have to be a very interesting thing indeed for him to go away, and even more interesting for him to say nothing about it. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say. And our producer, partner extraordinaire, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. I'm happy to be back on the After Things podcast.
Man, it's so weird. Like, I spend so much time in the Weird Things podcast, like, making you a bad guy that I want to kill.
Oh, on Journey Quest?
On Journey Quest. And then, and then I have to reset myself and say, no, he's a partner in this operation.
I could still be a bad guy.
That's fine.
I'm glad to hear you're taking it so seriously. It's affecting your actual image of me. Actually, though, that kind of reminds me of a funny, really quick thing before we get into our main topic, is we just shot that skit for the Scam School page.
By the way, you did. Can I tell you a little bit about this?
Please.
We had which, by the way, I didn't know. I guess stabbings are a fad thing in the news of terrorism.
Yes.
Yeah.
England has been dealing with some pretty bad knife situations.
So that's unfortunate timing. but we've got a pen that has a hidden knife in it, which is actually super useful for opening boxes, and it's basically like a letter opener and so on. And so we wanted the whole, instead of normally what we do is we have me and David talk about, like, hey, here's the thing, and it's really useful for this reasons and so on. And we thought it would be funny to just do a short little comedy sketch. And so it's a simple 3-beat comedy where Brian is a jerk boss. And he comes in and says something terrible to David. David looks like he's about to go psycho, opens the knife, and then uses it for something sensible, like opening a letter or opening a box or whatever. And then the third beat is, you know, the quiet kid in the background turns out to be the psychopath.
Ooh, spoiler alert.
Sorry. That 90-second spoiler.
But I was having a similar thing of, like, editing you being a deliberately, like, mean bad boss,
right?
And then having to go through, like, this feedback process with you, and
I felt like the mean boss when I'm like, no, make it better
a little bit.
It came out great. If you haven't seen it, take a look at it was posted on Friday on the Scam School channel.
Sounds cool. Can't wait to see that. And I'm sure it won't be controversial at all. Be perfect. Yeah.
I think it's performing really well.
Yeah, it's performed really,
but I think
really well.
You've given it more juice than any other video lately. I feel like you've tweeted about it a lot.
Yeah. Well, and plus also there was the interesting thing of, like, it being popular, but also getting, normally a Scam School episode gets between 3% and 5% thumbs down. And usually the thumbs down are either, I know this trick already, or I like that trick. Why are you explaining it to anyone? Mm-hmm. Whereas this one had like 10% thumbs downs. And I don't know if that's because this is an ad, why are you giving me an ad? Or you're not very good at doing comedy. Or if they're saying, sure, there's been a rash of stabbings.
Probably all three. Yes. Probably all three.
So, stabbings are bad. Let's just make it clear, everybody.
Well, and of course, that's the whole joke. Like our bit is only funny if we all agree that stabbings are bad.
Yeah. The pro-stabbing lobby, just back off. While I've been away and totally not a court ordered prison sentence at a halfway house, totally not that at all.
Let's not
put
that
word to bed. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, can we stop that hashtag, put him back, lock him back up?
Lock him back. Lock him back.
Lock him. Hashtag lock him back. Wait, can
it's
we stop
no more
it?
Of that. No,
yeah, because it was
chant
never
exactly
true.
Like that anymore.
So life has been very hectic, and I've probably experienced what a normal person goes through. You know, Because normally I try to keep my life as stress-free as possible, as, you know, avoid of any sort of complications as I can. But then all of a sudden I found myself dealing with a lot of stuff I had to handle all at once. And in particular, what I had to deal with, among everything else, was finishing a book. I had to finish the third Theo Kray novel.
So I'm going to do my best to keep everything in bounds here. But we've already established that whatever it is you're working on is important enough that it took you away for an entire month from Weird Things and After Things. And also it's important enough that you can't talk about it. I would imagine whatever that thing is, it's important enough that you would be tempted, were you able to just say, let's just push this third book. But my guess is you did not have that option and instead needed to lock everything up again.
Yeah. I mean, it's publishing can sometimes be flexible and stuff. And you, as an author, you can say, oh, it's just not coming. It's not working for me or whatever. I never want to be that guy, you know? And so I pride myself on delivering what I say I'm going to deliver, you know, and getting things done and just finding the way to get things done. You know, I was in a position with Looking Glass, the current Theo Kray book, which is out right now, number two, which I had a ridiculously short amount of time to write that book. I had a really, really short amount of time to write that book. But I did what I could, made a very detailed outline, did everything I can. And I was super nervous when I finished that book because I wrote that book probably faster than the other novel I ever wrote. Bryce, why don't you go highlight there on the stars to see what the total rating is?
Apparently that was not a problem. Oh, look at that.
4.7 out of 5 with 249 reviews.
I'm tempted to not even say that there's 0% one-star reviews because that usually makes some jerk decide.
I'm sure
that
technically there is when you have 249 reviews. There could be a couple reviews there. There's 0 stars. It's fine. But anyhow.
Still, that's so we've talked before, like what you don't want to be is a U-shaped curve on the ratings because a U-shaped curve implies that your 5-star reviews are astroturfed and then actually it's a 1-star product or whatever. This is an extremely strong, like everything about this screams authentic, pleasing to the fans, well worth reading.
Yeah, and I think when it goes larger or bigger audience, it will probably go down. When it first started, I was like, if I just get a 4, if I get an average of 4 out of 5, I'll be happy because it's a sequel. Sequels traditionally in series are hard. Sequels are often the ones that take the biggest hit because you're sitting there trying to figure out, you know, what do people want? What do people want? And
when you look at The Naturalist, which had a lot of publicity, right, because of the Amazon first.
Yeah, nearly 5,000 reviews, and it's very much, it's like a geometric progression starting at 2% 1-star and ending with 60% 5-star.
Yeah, it's a 4.3 out of 5, which I was thrilled with for a book that got
so much
presented to everybody.
Exposure.
This was shown to everybody. This sold well over 100,000 copies. And so I was very happy. I got a 4.3. I'm like, this is great. I would read a book and I read anything with 3.5 or above. I'd feel no problem and I'll read it. I'd have to read through the reviews at 3 or whatever to see what's going on. And then to have Looking Glass do so phenomenally with the reviews so far, I'm taken aback and I'm amazed. So going into the third book, you're just like, you've got that pressure now too, because it's kind of like, I didn't know how the second one was going to do, and I don't know where I'm on the third one. And I'm trying to tweak the formula even more.
Interesting because this third book is the first place where the success or lack thereof of books 1 and 2 affect the way the story of the third one is told. This is, and I guess for the first time, I'm realizing this is probably true for all authors where it's the third book or so where the feedback loop, where the story becomes, I don't want to say self-referential, but affected by the outside success of it.
I would say most it's the second. The reason is that most authors, like, they don't have as much time between them as I have a less amount of time rather than between these books. Because remember, Naturalist came out in November. Looking Glass came out in March.
Right.
So that was a 4-month.
Well, and you pretty much had it, it was presented at the time as pretty much like a 2-book deal, right?
Yeah, I did a 2-book with them, and then now I've done another 2-book deal with them. And that's announced. So anyhow, that was the thing. So yeah, that was the thing. And again, as an author, you look at other authors, their second books, like I've been very lucky that my second books in my series have actually had better critical receptions than the first ones. Like that was, Name of the Devil was nominated for the Thriller Award. And right. then with Blackfall, which is now up for the Edgar Award, which is that was phenomenal to have that happen. And then and my point with these things isn't just like, well, look at me. And the, is it you don't know. You just follow a plan. You stick to the plan and you hope the plan works and you get the end of the book. And then if it works out, it's great. And I talk about this all the time. Like, I don't know yeah. if I like my thing.
And for it's kinda like, for the record, uh-huh. just I don't think anybody begrudges. I would hope that the folks who listen to After Things don't begrudge any of us telling the truth about something that turns out to be successful because mm-hmm. we're so good about talking about the things that are unsuccessful. None of us claim like we know what we're doing or that or that we're great. You know, our goal is to tell the truth of what it's like to be playing this ridiculous game and tell the highs and the lows of it as best we can so that you guys can play too.
Yeah, I'll talk about so writing Murder Theory was a struggle because all these other things pulling my time away, which if you know, I've always been sympathetic towards authors with families and other commitments and stuff. I always understand that. And when I talk about, oh, writing a book in a week, you know, that's assuming you have no other obligation, that you're not trying to deal with a huge project and other things and people calling you multiple times a day saying, you know, get on the phone, having to talk between two lawyers about stuff or whatever. You know, that's assuming that you can just have a week in isolation. You can do that. You can do amazing things. But even then, it can be problematic trying to focus. I started making a checklist because I said, if I have 2 hours to write, I got to make that 2 hours work. And number one is you got to know what you're going to do. You got to know when you sit down to write. Like if I got to write a chapter, I've got to have the conflict of the chapter. I got to know how it starts and how it ends. I can do that anywhere. I can stand in line and think about that while I multitask or do something else because I'm not writing a lot. I can spend a half an hour thinking of three sentences that let me know what it is. If I have that, the ingredients list or the recipe, so to speak, of this is what's going to be, that I'm set. Every time I've struggled, it's because I did not have that. I sat down there trying to solve those problems at the keyboard, and that's the worst time to do it, in my opinion. You know, you can settle on the keyboard if you're writing an outline. Solve that problem before you're trying to figure out how you're going to show it. So doing that, number one, was super helpful. Then I came up with my steps to get into the zone. How do I get into the zone for writing? And
like a ritual, like a pre-writing ritual or something?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it. I mean, a ritual was a really, I mean, you could describe it as a ritual, but it was yeah. literally like, what do I need? And I said, okay, one is I gotta distract myself from everything around me. I put in my headphones and I start listening to a soundtrack. So I'm less paying attention to external stimuli. Now I'm just back inside of my head and what I'm doing. Clearly off Twitter, clearly off of that. And so now all of a sudden I'm back into my own low because like I focus the most when I get a massage. And so I just put my – because you're just detached from everything else. I put myself into that mode using my headphones and all of a sudden I'm in Andrew's space. Then I'll say if I need to write in 15, 20 minutes, you know, they used to say like, oh, put on your gym shorts, you know. Like if you put on your gym shorts, you're going to be in the mood to go to the gym. You're halfway there.
Right, right. Just adopt the trappings of whatever success looks like, and then you feel the need to complete the picture.
And I've adopted another one, which was because I noticed if I want to work out in 20 minutes, half hour, I'll eat a piece of fruit and then put on my gym clothes because my energy will start to spike.
The sugar.
And then it's very easy. And so what I do with this, the same thing. So what I would do is like if I'm feeling low energy, start listening to the music. Okay. Then have like a fruit smoothie. And I notice about 20 minutes, my energy goes – I'm in the mode, I'm super alert, and I'm ready to write, and then I could just keep going. So that was the three factors, was know what I need to do, separate myself from, you know, put myself in my own space, then three, give myself the right amount of energy I need to go do it.
So I have a really, really hard time entering, and tell me if I'm representing this correctly. Like, have we talked much about flow state on After Things?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit.
As we've talked about on Weird Things, for all I know, tomorrow they'll tell me flow state is not a real thing. But subjectively, flow state's a very real thing for me.
That's what I'm trying to attain. That's very much what I'm trying to get into.
And it seems like for me to summon that beast requires a certain amount of pressure. There needs to be a terror of the deadline. And lately, I've wondered if for the last couple of years – I haven't been suffering from an embarrassment of flexibility, and I wonder if For example, Penn Jillette has talked about how from the moment he wakes up to the moment he goes to bed, every single moment is scheduled. And he's constantly, he's like, well, I got 15 minutes to meet this person and now I'm on to the next thing or whatever. There's part of me that thinks like, man, if I could just afford a personal assistant to hold me to task, to force me from moment to moment to moment to moment, if that wouldn't be a good thing. But absent that, because I can't afford that and I can't be that person, what structures can I lean on to cause me to stand up and make stuff happen? And I think that for the past 20 years, you know, up until like 3 or 4 years ago when I stopped touring as much as I did, all of that was baked in. I lived in 4-hour increments. It's 5 a.m. I'm awake. That means it's time to go to the airport. It's 8 a.m. We're taking off. We're landing. My job is to have a sleep on this plane. It's now 2 in the afternoon. I've landed. My job is to make it to the hotel. It's 5 in the afternoon. That means it's time for me to take a shower, get ready for the gig. It's 7 in the evening. My job is to be setting up the show. It's 8. It's time for the show. It's 11 o'clock. Oh, it must be time for me to have dinner with the folks afterwards. It's midnight. My job is to go back to sleep. That was such a powerful, powerful, almost narcotic. That freedom of knowing at any given moment, there's nothing else on this planet that you're meant to be doing except for what you're doing is so delightful. Mm-hmm. Compare that to the challenges that I deal with now is like, it's morning. It's time to take the kid to school. It's the rest of the day. And here's a gigantic amorphous list of things that I know that I ought to do, and none of them do I have to do. And there's part of me that deeply, deeply craves that power of being up against a deadline where it's do or die. Whatever you do, this is what's going on the record. Just do the best you can and go.
I would say that, and there's a reason why people sometimes don't want to leave military life or prison or other sorts of regimented sort of lifestyles, and they suffer when they're out of it. But I would say that my most productive periods were when I had no external schedules. I was dealing all with internal ones. But it came from me deciding, and that carries over now where I go, for this week, this is what I have to do. Or for these 3 hours, this is the most important thing for me. And it killed me not to be doing weird things because that was always Monday. That was the most important thing. But then when I had project stuff and writing stuff that I said, I am overwhelmed with this stuff. Weird things will function without me if Brian and Justin do it. And when we have this agreement, whatever, somebody needs to go do something, whatever, we'll manage the Slack. And you guys have been there for me great, which I appreciate. So I'm like, okay, now the most important thing is blank. And I have, and it kind of comes down to, I don't do overlapping things. If I say I need to do X, like I'll try to break my stuff into this day is this project, this day is that project. If I'm done with that thing at the end of the day, then I can start on the other thing. I break my time down like that. But like I had to get this, I actually had to write 2 books this year. You know, I wrote another book, which is a spec book. And then I wrote another book, this book, in the middle of this other stuff. And it was crazy trying to write two books in 3 months.
For the uninitiated, a spec book means a book you're writing on speculation. Like basically, I'm going to write this book, and hopefully you like it, and it goes somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. It's a book that like, oh, I think, you know, discuss with my agent. I'm like, I think this is a really promising thing. And then, you know, she mentioned it to some people, and they got super excited about it. And she was excited, and they were super excited about it. I'm like, okay, let me do this thing. And then I did this thing, and then, you know, I did that, and then that. And then on top of some other stuff relating to this project. I had a lot of things, but I would say, you know, for that, I'd say I'd give myself X amount of time from point A to point B to go do this and do this. The problem I had was trying to figure out like, this has been very helpful for me learning how to schedule and how much stuff I can take on and what I can't. That was the other part, was to realize it. Like, I will tell you, the thing I'm about to go do is the most stressful. You'd think it'd be the most stressful thing in the world. But once I finished that book, my stress level dropped tremendously. Like,
and that's a case where it's like the dance floor is cleared. You only have eyes for one project, and it's just the two of you doing all your stuff.
Yeah, all my stress now is stuff relating to that. Like, you know, there's a certain amount of training and other stuff going into it, and these other things. A lot of moving parts to it, but it's the payoff is great. But yeah, not having to worry about the book obligation now is super helpful. But anyhow, I would say that, you know, I did a book party couple weeks ago. I was in New York, and you know, a woman had asked me, like, you know, like, oh, what's your you know, what kind of writing space should I have, or should I have? And I'm like, well, I have my environment that I prefer to write in, but you've got to get that out of your head. You got to get out of your head that you need this special place to write in, because you're going to find out that if you want to be a high, you know, if you want to be, you know, a high productivity writer, or you just get things done, you got to write anywhere, anytime you can. And I try to confine my writing to here and sort of this environment, just so it doesn't overflow into my life too much. But when it needs to, I let it go elsewhere. And that's when I use headphones to focus. I've learned to write on my phone and do all these other things. But having that deadline, having that time frame is certainly, I understand the value of it, but you can inflict that on yourself.
Well, to a point, but it's tough because...
Like, is there anything stopping you from saying, okay, so I have these dead set things that I have to do. I have the gym, I have the kids, I got this, that, or the other thing. And then just saying, hey, I'm picking literally any time on the calendar and I'm making it a weekly thing.
I think
this is my Twitter time. This is my Gmail time.
I think in my heart of hearts, I just know that it so this is what I'm wrestling with is there's what's urgent and what's important. And what's urgent has a natural time barrier in it. It's like, hey, man, you got to get this, either is handled now or never. Whereas what's important is obviously more important, but it very often does not have that barrier. And as a result, like, I look at email is one of those things where there's so much there. And we've talked about this before. I get between, you know, 100 to 300 emails a day. And a lot of them I can either ignore. As I go through, I can either ignore them, I can respond with one or two lines, and then there's that frustrating third category of, like, this is important and merits a deeper look. And as a result, it just gets stuck there for, you know, up to a month, 2 months, 3 months. And then it's as I work my way back, at this point right now, I'm at just under 2,000, quote, important and unread emails. And when I do really well, when I hit those periods of flow state where it's like, the stars align, I'm just listening to techno music or whatever, and I'm just plowing through emails, and I get all the way back. I'm traveling back in time. Like, now I'm back to February. Now I'm caught up back to January. Now I'm back to December. And then there's this strange clarity that comes when you get on the other side of it, where you're like, now I'm back to July of last year, where I write and I actually copy and paste the phrase, finally clearing out the inbox, comma, just got to this, dot, dot, dot. And I just paste that at the beginning of all these. And half of those things I end up saying, whatever became of this project, or how did that work out? Or who did you get for this gig since I never responded to you? And it's astonishing how in some ways, and I hesitate to admit this, in some ways, there's a clarity that comes from delaying responding to everything, and mm-hmm. so much of what was in your inbox does not matter, and you can only see that 6 months in the future.
It is very easy to reach out and send an email to somebody, and so I try to handle email with the same expectation of which I send it. If I'm sending something, a query or something, to somebody who I know is a very busy person, and whose primary job is not communications, you know, like, if I send it to a company as a PR head or something at a company, like, yeah, you need to respond. You know, that's your job. But if I'm sending it to another author or something like that, I don't expect a response. And I make my email sort of self-contained or whatever, you know, and also, like, if you have the time, respond. If not, and I try to make that way. And that's my reaction, is that I'm not like, well, so-and-so is such a big shot and respond to me. I'm never like that, because, you know, it's –
Well, it indicates more about your unfair projections on a person you've mm-hmm. never met or had business dealings with than it does about, you know, their poor communication skills.
Yeah, I get emails from people who, you know, are, you know, very sincere, but like, hey, I'd like to work with you or do this, that, and they're very long, and it's like, maybe there's something to talk about, but I just don't have the time to really talk about this at this time. And they don't, their world is not, they're not getting the hundreds of emails a day you and I get. And it's hard for them to understand.
This is a linked tangent. I hopefully this will be a short trip, but what I want is your absolution on this. You know that I don't like to block or mute people on Twitter. You know that all things being equal, one of the reasons that I love to respond to YouTube comments and on Twitter is because I can make good. I get that endorphin rush of like, I'm responding to you, and that's done, and that's done, and that's done. Mm-hmm. In this case, I had somebody who, you know, I follow a lot of people, especially hopefully people who are likely to have been fans of mine. And I got direct messages from a guy who was like, hey, I really, really like your stuff. I have questions for you. How do I get started in Magic? And so I responded through DMs of like, have you seen this exchange between me and Teller? And then the dude was like, or he's like, no, I haven't. Will you sum it up for me? And I'm like, bro, I just sent you a link. If you're not going to read the link, I don't know that there's much for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then it was, well, that's the thing is like, you know, as a policy, I don't just click on any links. And I was like, okay, well, hey, friendship is based on trust. So when you want to be friends, just trust me. And he's like, well, I don't know about that. And then, and it became this like descending into, and I just responded like, hey, let me say it again. When you want to be friends, and I do want to be friends, trust me, you extend trust and we'll be there.
I feel like that's putting a lot. There was a thing probably about a year ago for one of these shows, and I was really unsure about whether to work it into one of the shows. One of the podcasts specifically.
Right.
And I was kind of wrestling with it. And when I told you and another person on that show about it, what you told me was you've thought way too much about it. So clearly you should not do it.
Exactly. And that's so what happened.
That's
again.
Why you should have stopped responding to him.
And you'll be proud of me because it took me a couple of revisions longer. But eventually I basically, you know, I responded again like, hey, man, whenever. And then he responded like all of a sudden I realized this person is getting what he wants. What he wants is to feel important by taking my time. And the moment I realized that, and I don't do this lightly, I full on blocked him because I realized like that is an unfair allocation. That is not fair to my children. That's not fair to my team. That's not fair to me and myself to be dedicating this to a back and forth Twitter argument for somebody, who over the dumbest crap. The dude didn't want to click on a link that led to the Teller letter.
Sure.
Like, that's what I tried to get him to read.
What made you block him in lieu of just, like, stop ignoring it?
Because I realized that I wanted the door to be all the way closed. It was the only way to be respectful to the rest of my time. And this person, and I decided in the future, if I'm ever called out about this, what will I say? And I was like, I will say this was occupying an unreasonable and unfair amount of my mental bandwidth, and it was not appropriate for my family or my team to maintain this, any kind of whatever this was. Because he was being right. Snide, but he wasn't being, you know, hostile or anything.
But I guess, like, is it that you couldn't trust yourself to not respond to
correct,
it?
Correct. I needed to not even be able to hear whatever he had to say next, because I knew that future Brian, whatever it was, I'd be tempted to dedicate, you know, three whole minutes to crafting a response. And this MFR did not deserve an unreasonable ask of in that regard.
I think you need something new, man. Like it, only because I see that you let people get under your skin and engage with them probably more than is healthy. And I don't know, man. It's tough.
I'm gonna offer my suggestion. And Brian, I'll say you're far better man than I am because you engaged with this guy far longer than I would.
And keep in mind, all of it comes from a place of ego on my regard. I am just constantly tempted to believe, well, I'm just better than everyone else. I could be friendly with everyone or whatever.
I look at it this way, I've had people like email about my books all the time. And it's great. Usually it's like, hey, I love your book, whatever. I'm like, great. And sometimes like, oh, well, I disagree at this. I'm like, oh, this was my choice. Why I did this? That's the end of it. I might get back like, da, 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 da. It's like, I responded to that. I gave you my thought in response. I don't have time. If I have a discussion about this with everybody who wants to have that discussion, I would never get another book done again. I try to respond to everybody who emails me about my book. I try to respond to everybody. Thanks. 99% of people are amazingly fantastic. Like, oh, thanks. That means a lot to me. I appreciate it. They don't follow up because they know from the brevity of the response, my time is short, and then they don't push it. Yeah, they don't push it, which is great. And I recognize names coming in again, and I wish I had more time to read them. And it makes me feel good to know that, oh, this person gave me a compliment, and I was able to thank them for that. And we're all good. We're all good. They know I want to write, and I know they want to read, and they want it. And sometimes I've had people like, hey, what up this? I'll give them a little more thoughtful response. And then I had somebody like, oh, you ignored the such and such person here. And I'm like, who did this? I'm like, well, actually, this is what happened, blah, 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 with this, you know, this actual historical person. But they're very interesting, blah, blah, blah. And then get this response like, yeah. But you get the people like, yeah, but they want to have that. Because if sometimes I get people who want to correct me, sometimes I'm wrong. But sometimes it's like, no, that's not quite. I'll go like, well, this is this thing. And they want to do the yeah, but. And I'm like, let them have it. Leave it. Let them have the last word. Just leave it there. And, you know, and sometimes it can drive people nuts. You know, I had a thing where I was standing outside with a friend and I'm watching this guy back up his car. And he's trying to clear this red zone. He's like 3 feet away. He's not asked to worry about the red zone. And he's heading pretty fast towards this other car. I'm like, dude, whoa, stop. And he comes like this close to the bumper. I'm like, dude, stop. And I'm looking in and he won't even look at me and go like this or whatever. He just ignores me. And then he gets out. And I'm like, dude, I was trying to yell at you. I just didn't want you to hurt your car, right? He goes, I got it. I'm like, I look over at his car and where the bumper is to the other car. I go, clearly. And he goes, what's that supposed to mean? I said, nothing. Well, no, what was that supposed to mean? Nothing. So I said, I got it. I'm like, okay. He says, why are you still talking? I'm like, I'm done talking. It was like he wanted to have a thing and he has to go over to his trunk and he can barely get his hand in to unlock the trunk because
he's parked so close to it. Yeah.
You know, and then, but all of a sudden I'm trying to be nice, but now all of a sudden, you know, I'm being aggressive now. Cause I'm like, and I did the, clearly because it was just like, and so it's like, I went from being, hey, I want to be a helpful guy to like, he was a jerk to me. So all of a sudden now I'm being antagonistic towards him, you know,
but it's tough too, because there are moments where doing something like a clearly moment is more effective than taking up all the words. Like we talked on this, I believe on this show, when I had to call out one of my neighbors for shooting of an air rifle at my, you know, $2,000 drone. Mm-hmm. It's like the clearest way to communicate instantly in five syllables or less was to call him an a-hole and tell him to knock it off or I was calling the cops, you know?
Yeah, this was a situation where my problem was like I went from wanting to be a helpful person to a person who wanted to be right and put him in his place. And that was the problem is that I went from here to all of a sudden, oh, no, you're an idiot. I'm going to tell you why. And that's like that was my mistake was what was my goal here? My goal is not to have this guy hurt his car. And then he was who knows what was going on, but he was so upset with me or he was embarrassed and whatever by the fact. And then he didn't want to have and it was just but then it's like I should have handled it better because. You know, I went from, oh, I'm just looking out for you to like, oh, well, F you, I'm going to make fun of you now because, you know, you're an idiot and I'm going to point out at you. And that happens online all the time is you right. get, sometimes people get argument and then I have to stop and say, this person, they use this many typos to tell me they spotted a typo in my tweet. No,
it's tough though, because I know for me, like I just want to believe I could be all things to all people. And of course that's factually clearly, not the case, you know,
no one can.
But it's, what I lack and maybe what I need is a clear delineation of who is and is not worthy of my time. And unfortunately, and that's not a value judgment on the people who are saying
these
things.
It's easy. Are they polite?
I mean,
or are they there? And you know enough now to tell
this guy. See, unfortunately, that's not a great example because this guy on Twitter was polite the whole time, but he was just wordy.
He was using polite language, but that's the difference. There's a difference between being polite and using polite language. He was using polite language, but he told you he doesn't trust you. He said, I don't trust you. Okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that point, it should have been just like you already did the thing that you were going to do and continued to do, which was just saying, here's the link that I'm going to give you. and I'm not going to do anything else. And you kind of just like that kept being your position.
Right. But
and he kept trying to break through that.
Just imagine his response was perfectly worded in such a way where he's just like, well, as a matter of policy, I don't. Surely you can understand that I don't have a policy of clicking on any link that comes through to me. If only I could, you know, in
good for him.
But again, he's at. But I look at polite's not just a matter of language. It's a matter of I'm asking this other thing for you. I was ungrateful for this other thing.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to ask you for this other thing. And to me, it's like it's math. I'm like, forget the language. Where is this transaction going? I want a thing. Here's the thing. That thing's not good enough for me.
Right.
It's the sort of thing where like if my reaction would be, well, you know, good for you or that's your problem or whatever, then that's where I'm going to leave.
Correct. But then you get four paragraphs back from him, you know, and it's choose to not even read those paragraphs?
Yeah.
Yes.
You guys are better people than me. I need to not even see them to be able to deal.
I don't do direct message on Twitter because I can't handle it. So I never did Facebook Messenger. I use email.
I'm surprised
you read
DMs.
And if I'm on Twitter
DMs
talking
all,
to people, I try to keep all my conversations public too in Twitter because it just doesn't get weird. And also it makes me mindful of not being this. It's I would say, Brian, you have to figure out, to me, it's ultimately my bandwidth. How much time do I want to spend on any one of those transactions?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah.
Have you
any picks? Bryce, you have a comment?
Because I've been thinking about a very similar thing a lot lately, and I feel like I'm 24 hours at any given moment away from like turning off all of my push notifications into like manual fetch, so that
so you could legitimately not have to hear all of these things begging for your attention.
Well, and it's not. I certainly don't get the volume that you guys do, but at the end of the day, that means anybody on Twitter gets to be on my phone at 24/7 and immediately. And it's like a lot of times that's great because that means replies and friends and whatever, but that it can also just mean that someone can do whatever.
They can occupy unearned real estate in your mind.
Yeah.
Which is a legitimate concern because like how much is the real estate in your mind worth? And as you certainly, you know, I'd imagine Andrew's ahead of both you and me put together in this regard, where it's just like, man, especially given this project you're working on, you simply would be doing a disservice to the interests that are supporting you to dedicate, you know, even 30 seconds, a minute to some rando on the street.
I learned that when I write, and I got comfortable using, hey, I'm writing, I can't respond or whatever. And I do. And people who get rude or angry with me not responding, it's like, I don't want to, you're not a person that this is going to be a productive conversation or relationship with. It's like, this is not, there's no future in this because this is how you're starting. So, and you know, people are, and then I try to make up for it. Like you make yourself very available, you know, online, and I try to make myself available when I do live streams.
Can I tell you the idea that I have, and I'm getting ready to, it's a month or 2 months away from doing kind of what I'm hoping will be a reboot of my schedule. And one of the things I'm thinking about doing is building into publicly making office hours available, where it's like, these are my office hours. Let's say it's Tuesday, Thursday, blank to blank, whatever. My Skype will be open. I'll respond to all messages. I'll do whatever. You know, but
I would say you don't need to open yourself up in ways that you aren't already, though.
But the only way to do this is to shut down the rest of the time. Just say, from now on, you have zero expectation of my time except for office hours, during which I will show up and I will do whatever I can as long as I can. Mm-hmm. And then those hours are closed and we're done.
That's what Periscope is for me. It's not a schedule, but my hardcore fans know that if I'm not on Periscope, they know I'm writing whatever. And I get, come back, whatever. And I come in there and do it, and I'll do as many as I can when I can. And then I'm like, and people know, like, I'm so transparent and open when I do those and free flowing. I think that balances out that I'm very hard to get to at other times. And you look at like, and I kind of like, I idolize like, you know, Elon Musk, because, and you could use like, we could take a really famous person and then divide the number of Twitter followers you have by the number of times they reply. That's what you're obligated to do, you know? And so you look like, yeah, that's what it is. And so when he will be on Instagram and he'll be there for a little, he'll be responding to some stuff, but we don't want to waste his time. Like, you know, when he's on Twitter, he does engage with people a bit, and then he goes and does his thing. He gets thousands of people asking him questions, and some people get irate, like, why don't you do this? You know, you should owe me. And it's like, he knows, no, I don't owe you anything. And if I gave everybody who wanted the, my time, there would be no time to make cars. And thus, if you gave everybody the time that they wanted, there'd be no time to make podcasts and do this and spend it with your family.
Like, it's so, no one person's job to make other people act better or to validate X, Y, or Z response.
You know, I've got a bail, speaking of time, because I made a time commitment. Do we have any picks?
You know what? I think I mentioned it before, but I'm really stuck on all the extras from the Thor Ragnarok extended cut thing on Amazon. I really enjoyed. Did you happen to see that? It was directed by Taika Waititi, the little reality show of where the, not the collector, the other one, the Grandmaster ended up.
I think I watched that.
Yeah.
I think I watched that.
He ends up as the roommate of the guy who used to be Thor's roommate.
Daryl. Yeah, whatever.
Daryl, yeah.
Daryl, yeah.
It's great. That's it's cool. Great. All of that
and,
is great.
And so that's just a digital extra?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've been playing a game lately. I could spend an hour talking about this, but I will keep it very short because Andrew's got to go. It's a sequel. It's the third sequel, second sequel. It's the third in a series called Danganronpa, Danganronpa V3 Killing Harmony. It is a surreal horror murder mystery game where it's basically if like Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, was a horror game. It follows.
So it's all about figuring out who the bad guy is from a cast of characters that all might look equally innocent.
Yeah. So like there are 16 students and they're all at least in some way related to like the idea of like ultimate students. Mm-hmm. So like you might have, oh, this is the ultimate Aikido student. This is the ultimate astronaut. This is the ultimate baseball player. And it creates this weird, interesting thing for murder mysteries where you're creating characters who have, at least in the universe, a justifiable reason to be extremely expertised at one thing. And by the short story is that they're kidnapped and they're forced to kill someone if they want to leave. And that creates very quick, like emotional breakdowns and mental breakdowns and interesting motives. So cool. I recommend that whole series. It's on PC now. Danganronpa.
Awesome.
My pick is Astoria. It's about John Jacob Astor's goal to create an trading empire based on the West Coast. It takes place in around 1810, 1812, 1813. That period, he and Thomas Jefferson had a conversation about the idea of creating another democracy. This one, you know, based in, you know, trying to capitalize on the seal fur trade, which actually was a huge global trade. And then had this succeeded, you know, there could have been one country on the West and one in the East. And he would have been, he was already an extremely wealthy man, could have been probably the wealthiest person in the world. It's a story of this ship they sent around the Cape Horn to go there, and then an overland expedition, because this is just like 2 years after Lewis and Clark went across America. And so it's an amazing story about what life was like then, what the story of expeditions, economics, all that. I've been listening on maybe like got 2 hours left. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a really, really great book. So a story. And it's really, you start thinking about this in the context of colonizing Mars and how economics work like that. So highly recommend Astoria.
Nice.
Gentlemen, it's good to be back.
Yeah.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.